Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the winners and losers in the proposed Republican Party health care plan. An excerpt of a speech by Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State, delivered at the Native Nations Rise March and Rally in Washington, D.C. And L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics, who talks about her new book titled Direct Action, which offers useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The smiling face of Donald Trump fills a billboard in the Serb-majority town of North Mitrovica, Kosovo. Serbs, who are a minority in Kosovo, were elated when Trump beat Hillary Clinton in last November's election. Many still hate Bill Clinton, who, as U.S. president in the 1990s, led bombing campaigns against Serb military forces in Bosnia and Kosovo during the violent breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Since a peace deal was signed in the Balkans, new ethnic tensions have resurfaced amid calls to reopen debate over borders and potential land swaps. In Bosnia, the autonomous Serb Republic regularly threatens to hold a referendum for independence. According to the Guardian newspaper, some Bosnian Serbs have supported the idea of boycotting the central government in Sarajevo, which has not accepted a ruling by the International Court of Justice, clearing Serbia of complicity in genocide during the Bosnian War. Conflicts between Albanians and Serbs never ended in the Balkans. One human rights activist observed, "It's Israel and Palestine in Europe." Western diplomats now worry 2017 may become a nightmare year with elections in Serbia and the growing likelihood of a snap poll in Kosovo. Indictments are also expected from a special court in The Hague, adjudicating crimes committed by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army, whose leaders now serve in Kosovo's political establishment. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has provided $315 million in financing to the New Jersey-based Connell Company, which sold equipment to mines in Africa accused of exploiting slave labor and of committing other human rights abuses. The financing deals from 2007 to 2015 involved 17 mining companies in sub-Saharan Africa. The Connell Company used U.S. taxpayer financing to supply equipment to the Bisha copper mine in Eritrea, which is under investigation by a Canadian court over accusations of using slave labor. The Canadian mining company Nevsun Resources, which runs the Bisha mine, faces a class action suit claiming Nevsun used the army to force military conscripts to work in their mine. The Connell Company, a family-owned conglomerate founded in 1926, is one of the largest recipients of financing from the Export-Import Bank, along with banking giants like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Connell Company donated almost $5.8 million to U.S. politicians from 1990 to 2016. After Donald Trump was nominated for president, Virginia activist Brittany Scherer decided it was time to commit to running for the state Senate. Scherer, an academic advisor at Old Dominion College, is not alone. Young women have flooded political training programs since Trump was elected in November, many concerned about reproductive rights and climate change. The new wave of feminist political activism comes just in time for the Democratic Party, which has lost control of the majority of state houses across the country. The current enthusiasm of women interested in running for local office is similar to what occurred in 1992, when the number of women candidates surged after the sexual harassment claims against Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas were dismissed by the majority of the U.S. Senate. The number of women in public office has grown since the 1990s, but has flattened out in recent years. According to the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, women make up just 19% of the seats in Congress and only 25% of all state legislators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Donald Trump and Republican Party leaders in the House and Senate have followed through on their campaign pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare. But the proposed GOP legislation, dubbed the American Health Care Act, shamelessly fails to live up to Trump's repeated promises on the campaign trail to provide health insurance to all Americans, ensure that all Americans will have quality health care for less money than Obamacare, and to never cut funding for Medicaid. On all three of those important pledges, the Republican health care bill flunks. Analysis of the legislation by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026 than under Obamacare, including 14 million that would lose their insurance by 2018. While the GOP bill would lower federal deficits by $337 billion over 10 years, largely as a result of cuts to Medicaid that would reduce enrollment, average health insurance premiums would rise by as much as 20% in 2018 and 2019 before falling in later years. If the Republican health care plan were to become law, an estimated 52 million people would be uninsured by 2026, compared to 28 million who lack insurance under the current law. More than 50 national organizations oppose the GOP's proposed health care plan, endorsed by President Trump, including AARP, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the Federation of American Hospitals, and the American Cancer Society. Your reporter spoke with Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Here, Friedman assesses the winners and losers of the proposed Republican Party health care plan.
Well, the plan could very well be seen as wealth care instead of health care. The one definite element in the Republican plan that has persisted throughout all the various permutations is that they're going to repeal all the taxes that fund the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And these are taxes that most people do not know about because they're only assessed on people earning over $250,000 a year. So they're getting rid of all the taxes, which is about $500 billion over the next decade. And all of that money is going to the top 1% of American households, most of it going to the top 1/100th of 1%. So those people are getting a lot of money. Now, since you're getting rid of the revenue, you have to find ways to cut spending. And they're doing it by doing away with the subsidies associated with the Affordable Care Act, subsidies that have gone to working people. They go to people earning less than four times the poverty line, which gets up to like $70,000 for families. And most of the subsidies go to people earning much, much less than that. Second, they are saving money by starting in 2020, basically phasing out the Medicaid expansion program that was part of the Affordable Care Act that mostly blue states, but a few Republican-dominated states, expanded Medicaid to cover people up to 140%, 138% of the poverty line, and also did away with all sorts of restrictions on Medicaid. And those two measures, the subsidies for people to buy individual health insurance plans and the Medicaid expansion, account for the dramatic drop in the proportion of Americans without health insurance. At this point, over 90% of Americans have health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act has worked to extend health insurance to people through subsidies for people to buy individual plans and Medicaid expansion. And those are both to be eliminated. The subsidies go right away and the Medicaid expansion after 2020. Also, while they're doing this, things get even worse because they will be pulling the rug out from the whole market structure that's been set up. The Affordable Care Act, by subsidizing people to buy health insurance and requiring that people have health insurance, although that's a requirement that has never been enforced, has established a market for individual health insurance, for people to buy health insurance as individuals. That's a market that pretty much did not exist before, because health insurance companies would look at people like, why do you want to buy health insurance as an individual? It must be that you expect that you're going to be sick. The health insurance companies are ready to walk away from the individual marketplaces if there are no subsidies and no mandate. The Congressional Budget Office, they're all Republicans over there now. The Republicans took over the House and Senate a couple of years ago, and they have full control over the Congressional Budget Office. So it's an old Bush administration economist. I'm sure he's competent, but their bias has been to downplay how bad this law is.
A quick question for you.
Yeah.
Several years ago, Dr. Steffi Wollhandler and David Himmelstein did a study that they published that talked about some 43,000 people would die if Obamacare was repealed, because although there's lots of criticism to go around about the Obamacare system, it essentially gave people insurance and access to preventive health care and saved lives. Do we have any idea what will happen if 24 million people lose their insurance by 2026 under this Republican plan? How many people would lose their lives?
Yeah, going back to the original study that Wollhandler, Himmelstein, and Wilper at Harvard Public Health did, I think it was 2003. I'm not totally sure of the year. But anyway, the original study, you'd basically figure 1,000 people die for every million people who lose health insurance. So if you have 24 million people thrown off health insurance, you'd be expecting about 24,000 more or less extra deaths in 2026. You'd expect 14,000 extra deaths next year. You know, put it in perspective, that's more than the number of Americans who died in 1967 in the Vietnam War. And we'd be doing that every year. People have to think about that, you know, in Congress. You know, how many Americans are you willing to kill?
I wanted to ask you about the possibility that this debacle in health care could result in some newfound political energy and popular support for Medicare for all, a single-payer system. Are you optimistic we are going to find ourselves moving towards single-payer in this country anytime soon?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, for two reasons. The first is the public energy, the resistance energy that's building up against the Trump administration and against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And second, destroying the Affordable Care Act is showing that we really need to do something dramatic to improve, to salvage health care in America.
That was Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Find more analysis of the proposed Republican health care plan and the single-payer alternative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 10th, thousands of indigenous people from across the U.S. gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Native Nations Rise March and Rally. The action was preceded by 2 days of prayer and ceremony on the National Mall. The march route went past the Trump International Hotel, where some participants had erected a teepee, and a group of women did a circle dance. The event began as rain turned to snow, and then back to rain, which was described as Mother Earth doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing by a representative of the Piscataway Nation who welcomed everyone to her homeland. The days of protest and prayer were organized by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which continues to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as the Indigenous Environmental Network and the Native Organizers Alliance. Participants carried banners opposing the Dakota Pipeline, as well as signs calling for Native consent, and not just consultation, for invasive projects on their lands. Following an executive order from Donald Trump, the Dakota Access Pipeline is now proceeding to completion under the Missouri River. But the tribe is still engaged in a court fight to stop it. One of the speakers at a rally across from the White House was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State. He read from a proclamation signed by the Yakama and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which opposes what it calls the doctrine of Christian discovery that justifies the invasion and exploitation of Native lands and peoples.
We carry a message and a warning here today. Love the earth. Love the waters of the earth. Love all forms of life. Care for them with deep and abiding honor and respect, and they will sustain you throughout time. However, be forewarned, if you poison and destroy them, they will poison and destroy you. That is natural law. Our ancestors bequeathed to us a sacred birthright of pure, pristine, and healing waters. Their prayerful and ceremonial manner of caring for the earth resulted in the purest rivers, springs, streams, and aquifers in the respective territories of our nations throughout this hemisphere. Our ancestors used their natural and innate intelligence to discern that water provides life force, the spirit upon all which life depends here on Mother Earth. Our ancestors were given and further evolved original instruction, natural laws, and wisdom teachings. Those instructions included the warning, remember, we follow in a prayerful manner these ceremonial and spiritual patterns of thought and behavior enable us to maintain a sacred and right relationship with the natural abundance of Mother Earth, interconnected with all life forms for all future generations. This is our life-sustaining message today. For more than 500 years, however, contrary forces of greed has worked to destroy our natural laws and our love for Mother Earth. They have greatly opposed our nations, our ceremonies, our teachings, and our sacred places in the name and in the idea that they call Christendom in Western Europe. The U.S. Supreme Court rulings and other U.S. actions have expressed these opposing forces, claiming a right of Christian sovereignty and dominion over the territories of the nations based upon the idea that Christian nations of Europe acquire jurisdiction over lands over heathens and infidels. The U.S. Justice Department made that exact argument in the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1954, Teton Indians versus the United States. The Justice Department even quoted Genesis 1:28 and the Book of Psalms from the Bible to support the claim of right Christian supremacy. This is a direct contradiction with the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the separation of church and state. We reject the pattern of thought and behavior premised on the Credo and Command, love riches and wealth, the Vatican Papal documents, and the colonizing royal charters written by self-described Christian monarchs that brought the Credo and Command here reveal the underlying code of domination and dehumanization used to attack our nations. The code of domination expressed a belief system that is willing to sacrifice everything on the altar of greed, even the sacred waters upon which life depends. To realize the unfortunate truth of this statement, one has to only think of the lead in the brains of the children of Flint, Michigan, where greed and disrespect for life destroyed rivers that once ran so pure you could drink from them, when our indigenous ancestors prayerfully cared for them since time immemorial. The government and corporate forces that oppose us have a great disdain for our organic laws and teachings, because the laws and teachings stand in the way of them fulfilling their love of riches and wealth. Those forces that oppose us are blind to the spiritual nature and the healing qualities of water. For them, water is simply a commodity, a means to create more riches and wealth, or a commodity to waste and destroy in search of riches and wealth. Therefore, we stand here today and offer the following statement as a proclamation. From the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Yakima Nation, we will read this forth and we will call upon all Native nations and all original and free nations of this earth to stand and sign on to this proclamation with us. The original proclamation of life, original nations proclamation. We understand that our Creator has uniquely brought forth our existence. Our creation is of free and original origin, grounded in love and sustained by divine instruction, resulting in an existence and awareness that has materialized since time immemorial on Turtle Island. We understand the ideas of domination and dehumanization, as these ideas are referenced within the divine instructions and warnings we have heeded since time immemorial for our sustained existence as original free peoples and nations. We understand that the inaccurate concept of discovery, formerly referred to as the doctrine of discovery, utilized by the monarchies of Spain and England, have unjustly manifested the idea of domination and dehumanization against our original free peoples and nations. We understand that the doctrine of discovery by historical monarchies was justified by unholy instruction issued by writ of papal bulls. We understand the dominating and dehumanizing force of manifest destiny utilized in the executive, legislative, and judicial formation of America. We understand the specific reference of the flawed and unholy idea of the doctrine of discovery in the origin of federal Indian law, cited in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1823 and reaffirmed in 1955 by the Supreme Court ruling Teton Indians versus United States. We understand the judicial precedent of the unchallengeable domination that is being utilized by America's judicial, executive, and legislative branches in the modern-day disputes with original and free peoples and nations, such as Standing Rock's fight with the advocacy of clean water. We understand that the negative ideas of domination and dehumanization warned about to our collective original free peoples and nations by and through divine instruction is the same negative idea that has been utilized by the Roman Catholic Church, the monarchies of Spain and England, and the United States of America.
That was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the Native Nations Rise Action and organized indigenous resistance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 1960s and early 70s was a period of great turmoil and change in the U.S. and around the world. While the decade of the 1950s was identified with conformity and repression, symbolized by Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, the 1960s saw a blossoming of powerful social movements. Among these was the critical struggle against racism and for civil rights, massive protests to end America's wars in Southeast Asia, and the birth of new movements for women's equality and the coming out of the LGBT community. A new book, titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism by L.A. Kaufman, captures the voices of activists and leaders from a wide range of movements that have roots in the 1960s and 70s. The book traces the links between these radical movements over four decades and the evolution of strategies and tactics they employed to change the national debate and transform America. Importantly, Direct Action also highlights the central role of women and queer organizers, as well as the enduring racial divisions that have shaped progressive activism. Your reporter spoke with L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, about the history covered in her new book, which she explains offers many useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement.
When I look at the history of these movements and these organizing traditions unfolding over the course of this 40-year period, I see time and time again that the people who have functioned as the bridges between movements, who have brought the skills and the tactics and the organizing techniques, including some of the ones like affinity groups and spokes councils and consensus decision making, the people who have carried that knowledge and those practices from movement to movement have been disproportionately women and disproportionately queer women. And that is just an observation based on decades of being in movements, of who, if you look at the through lines from the anti-nuclear movement to the Central America work and then to ACT UP, for instance, most of the men in ACT UP were political novices. It was the lesbians in ACT UP who were the folks who had done Central America work or who had been part of the women's peace encampments and brought all of these organizing skills. And so I think it's very fitting that as I say, it was kind of the kickoff party or the coming out for the resistance, the Women's March, which was, really a decentralized mobilization. People really self-mobilized. It had many different voices in it and is led by women. I've been incredibly, repeatedly surprised by the breadth and scope of the resistance that's emerging now. We're obviously facing an unprecedented challenge, But the scale and character of what I'm seeing is so different from anything I've seen in decades. It's so much broader. It's so much kind of livelier. It's coming in from so many unexpected quarters that although we're facing challenges like I've never seen, I feel encouraged that our movements are going to continue to resist strongly as Trump attempts to implement his policies and are going to be thinking very strategically about 2018 and 2020 and the longer road ahead.
In terms of the challenges for the Trump resistance movement, it seems that keeping up the high energy and the just incredible momentum that has built up in these last couple of months is difficult, is certainly a challenge, as well as sustaining that movement and that energy over the long haul. Do you have any advice for activists and organizers about the lessons that you've taken away from your living and working through the history of these last 40 years of radical movements?
Well, obviously people need to pace themselves and think about self-care and be judicious in not burning themselves out in the short run. But there are times that require more of us, that ask us to do more and stretch ourselves farther. I think people are already doing that, and I think that's what we have to continue doing. We know that protest movements can be quite effective, and right now, civil society is the only check on the Trump administration, really, that there is. So I encourage people to, yes, be thoughtful about their participation so they can think about the long run, but to understand that these are such extraordinary times that it's a time for all of us to see what we can do to stretch ourselves and be a little bolder and really persist, because that's what victories come from.
That was L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, talking about her new book titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. Find links to Kaufman's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.